Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 30. Today's guest is Major Sydney Jax. Sydney is an adjutant general officer in the United States Army. She attended the University of Scranton on an ROTC scholarship, where she also played basketball and received a degree in communications. She has attended Airborne School and served at the 82nd Airborne Regiment, and she has also attended Ranger School and served at the 75th Ranger Regiment. Recently, she started an Instagram page called Balance Your Grit, which acts as a network for trailblazing Army women.
Steady, nice and steady. Light, heel, cover. I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
So you better get out of my way now.
So you better get out of my way now.
Before I roll all over you.
Before I roll all over you.
Sydney, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad we finally nailed down a time to connect.
I know, it's been a long time coming. It's been like a few months now, so thank you for having me.
I looked at the email, and the last one when I was sick, it was actually exactly 1 month ago from today, so it worked out.
Nice.
And so where did you grow up?
So I grew up in central New Jersey, northeast U.S., born and raised there. My dad grew up there. So I'm a Jersey girl and youngest of four. I played basketball my whole life, sports my whole life. And I was recruited to play basketball at the University of Scranton in Northeast Pennsylvania, a small D3 Jesuit school. And on my recruiting trip, I found out about the ROTC program. So that was my path into the Army, really.
Okay. And did you have any military members in your family?
So my father is a Vietnam vet. He served two tours in Vietnam as a naval officer. And both of my grandfathers were in World War II. And there's actually a pretty long legacy. So my last name, Jax, came over to America prior to the Revolutionary War. And we have a Jax that's fought in almost every American war back to the Revolutionary War. So it's not like it was expected of me to serve. But patriotism and service was always important to my father.
So it was definitely something that you were thinking about even before you sort of found out about the ROTC program?
Kind of. It was always in my mind. I didn't want to go to West Point or the Naval Academy. I wanted a normal college experience. I had a pretty rough high school experience in my life, pretty rough teenage years. And I wanted to actually experience a healthy social life and explore who I was. And I just didn't see myself being able to do that at an institute or an academy. And I wanted to play basketball. So basketball really was my first identity and my first love. So being recruited to play basketball in college, that was very important to me to get to play. And it just worked out with the ROTC scholarship. And obviously my father was pretty supportive of that. Especially because it paid for my 4 years of college. I wouldn't have been able to go to a small private school if I didn't have it paid for. So.
And so for those listening, I guess, what would be sort of a small description of what the ROTC program actually is?
So having a four-year scholarship meant that I had to do 4 years active duty, 8 years total. Almost thinking of it as per semester is almost a year of service. And we would have, so I have a minor in military science, and you have courses that you're supposed to take. So learning in the classroom about the military, about the Army, we would wear our uniform to those classes. And once a week, we would have a 2-hour lab where we're actually outside learning tactics, doing hands-on stuff, being out learning land nav, learning weapons, learning just tactics, infantry tactics, really. And once a semester, we would have a field training exercise for about 2 to 3 days, we would go to an offsite, a local military installation, and practice our military tactics. And in college, in ROTC, everyone is learning the same thing, and it's all infantry tactics. So then the summer before your senior year, you go to a month-long assessment with all of the other cadets across the country. I think there's probably about 8 to 10 different battalion-sized groups of cadets going through. And you're tested on everything that you've learned. So that's your final exam. And then your senior year is really prepping you for when you graduate college. That's when you commission as a second lieutenant. So you're competing for your branch of choice, installation, some, you know, especially now they're competing for active duty versus reserves and National Guard, you know, and your senior year is really that prep year for commissioning. And your first 3 years are prepping you for that month-long assessment.
Is ROTC something that every college in the States has, or are there only certain ones?
So I don't think, if a school doesn't have it, you can go to a sister school that has an ROTC program. And then there are key universities that are the host school. So for the University of Scranton, our battalion of cadets included like King's, Wilkes, Misericordia. I think there's probably about 5 or 6 different schools in the surrounding area, like 30 mile radius that the central hub was at my university. But I don't think every school has a program. A number of them do. They're much more condensed in the Southeast and Northeast, just East Coast in general. There's more programs on the East Coast than out West, really.
So you're going through college, you're playing basketball, and you're also doing ROTC. Was it hard to balance all of this at the same time?
Yeah. But it wasn't anything new to me because I was always playing on a lot of sports teams and doing clubs in high school. So it wasn't, I was already kind of trained for that through my youth and just the expectation of being on multiple sports teams, being involved in after school activities. So it was difficult and also balancing a social life, but my roommate for 2 years, actually of my 3 years, of my 4 years in college, 3 of my years, I had a roommate who was also an athlete and an ROTC. So just being around friends that were kind of doing the same thing made it a little bit easier, but it was difficult, especially because basketball, it goes from October to March. So that's really your whole school year. I had a coach that supported me doing ROTC, and my ROTC cadre supported me doing basketball. So because I had both sides really supporting me was the main reason I could balance it.
And what made you want to get involved in so many different activities and sports when you were growing up?
I loved sports. I grew up in a very athletic family. 2 of my siblings are college coaches, 1 for basketball, 1 for men's lacrosse. So I just grew up in a very sports-driven family, athletics-driven family, competitive, and it just kept me busy. I didn't really have too much of a social life other than school and sports. I just didn't really know any other reality as a kid, like looking back on it, honestly.
Right. Yeah. I'm just wondering because I was an only child and I just wanted to try all of the activities, as many different ones as I could. And my dad would go out and throw the ball with me or play tennis or do some activities, but my mom wasn't particularly involved in sports. So I'm not really sure where it came from, but I just wanted to try everything I could. And I'm still kind of like that to this day.
It's just fun learning new things or just getting out there and doing stuff. So
it is. Yeah. And I'm always interested in people who stick to just one sport, you know, and sort of dedicate their life to that sport, trying to go to the Olympics or play professional versus someone who just tries every sport, but they're not at the professional level.
Yeah. I mean, basketball, there were times that I would be playing on 2, maybe 3 teams all at once. And I just loved it. Like I just loved to play. And so that was my thing.
And so while you are going through this ROTC training, how do you decide which branch to choose?
Oh, that's a really good question. So it's difficult too, because we're talking about like 18 to 22 year old kids, and all we're really being taught is infantry stuff. And I was good at that. I was good at the infantry thing. That wasn't an option yet for us, for women at the time. There were discussions about it. but it wasn't yet open, and Ranger School wasn't even an option yet. But I had gone to airborne school as a cadet, and I was athletic. I was good at those things, but I just didn't want to do that. Maybe there was intimidation in there, but I think I just wanted something different. And I was at LDAC. That's like the month-long assessment before your senior year. And that's really the first time you're exposed to different branches coming in. So are you talking about my specific branch within the Army, or Army versus Navy, Air Force and stuff?
Both. Yeah.
Okay. So I chose Army because I got a 4-year scholarship out of it. And I didn't want to go in the Navy because I would go like fishing with my dad and my brothers, and I was fine on the river. But one time we went like deep sea fishing, and it was horrendous, and I was terrified, and there were huge waves, and I was like, get me out of here. So I like listening to my dad talk about being on a battleship with like 20-foot waves. I was like, that is not for me. So that's how I really ended up Army. But so for the branches specifically within the Army, once we started getting branch week after my junior year, I wasn't really vibing with a lot of the branches, and I was just waiting for the waiting for the branch that I was like, oh, this is really interesting to me. And the Adjutant General branch is the personnel branch of the Army. And maybe they just had the most energetic people giving the pitch, but they kept stressing, you know, we're the ones that take care of like military human resources is a little bit different than the civilian side. It's a lot different. And they just kept stressing strength management, operational management, casualty operations, like promotions, and just taking care of the people. I was sitting in like the commo, and they're talking about radios and equipment, and MI is talking about the enemy and like finding the enemy and analyzing the enemy and everything. But that the Adjutant General just brief spoke to me. My cousin's a Navy SEAL, and at the time he was a Navy SEAL. And I just kept thinking about, I just want to take care of people like that. And they also stressed the fact that in that branch, you can be assigned to any type of unit. So I could be assigned to a combat arms unit. I could deploy with any different types of unit rather than being infantry in an infantry unit. I could be AG in an infantry unit. So I was ranked pretty high on the OML across the board for cadets that year for the commissioning cadets. So I knew I had a good chance of getting whatever branch I wanted. So I chose AG, and that's what I got.
Everyone must be working pretty hard if the people who are sort of don't rank very high don't get their top choices.
Yeah, and there's a whole algorithm behind it where there's some people that are in the top 10-15% get branches that other people don't want. So they have a whole algorithm. So even if you're super high ranked, you may not get your first pick because they want to spread out the talent. But I was ranked high enough to get one of my top choices, and I got what I wanted. So
it's interesting the way they do it in the US compared to Canada, because in Canada, going to the military college, you choose your occupation before you even start. So, you know, you're maybe 17, 18, choosing like, okay, I'm going to be an artillery officer, or I'm going to be like a naval warfare officer before you even go to your first year of university, just based off of, you know, what you hear and a video that you may have seen on the recruiting website. So what did your training look like to get fully qualified in your occupation?
It was so easy, honestly. Like the AG, I love my branch, which is why I've stayed AG this whole time. The schooling, it's the shortest officer course. It's 3 months long. The school itself is pretty easy, but the job itself is, it has such a spectrum. Like it has such a, it's almost like throughout the history of the Army, after the infantry, actually the AG branch was formed. It's like the oldest branch other than the infantry, because it's old. And so it feels like throughout history, whatever had to do with people was just thrown into our branch. So, I mean, we're talking like mail and postal operations to casualty operations to morale and welfare to pay to legal to all of this huge spectrum of like anything that deals with the person. That's the S1 and that's AG. So I think they keep our schoolhouse course pretty short, just broad overall learning of just what in general we're supposed to learn, and then they just throw you out into the job. So the classroom stuff wasn't really that difficult. Mostly they're teaching us how to control F a PDF regulation. They're teaching us how to quickly find an answer rather than memorizing everything, because it's almost impossible to memorize it. So the skill they're teaching us is how to find an answer. So, I mean, if you've gone through college, you're already kind of skilled in that. So then I went through that 3-month course and got to Fort Bragg in December of 2012, where I was a postal platoon leader and I ran a post office. I deployed my platoon to 4 countries between Jordan, UAE, Qatar, and Kuwait for 9 months, ran postal operations and postal support for CENTCOM. And then I came back to Fort Bragg. About a week before I deployed, I was told I was going to an airborne infantry battalion in the 82nd to be their battalion S1 and run their HR. And that was right when they started opening Ranger. So right before my deployment was when they sent the first few women to Ranger school. So that was right when they started integrating and opening up more units to women in support roles or into those actual MTOs. And I showed up on my first day and was told, you're the first female assigned to any of these 3 airborne infantry battalions in the brigade. So I found that out my first day and I was like, okay, cool. Like, all right, like, here we go.
Like, were you treated any differently or did you just feel like it was sort of a normal work environment?
So I was in that job for 2 years and there were definitely multiple moments where I was treated differently, but I had fantastic leadership that protected me. And I worked for a battalion commander and a command sergeant major that my first day, my first counseling, they just straight up told me, you know, the success of your integration, like this is going to be difficult. There's going to be challenges. There's people here that don't want you here, but your integration into our unit is our responsibility and your responsibility is to do your job. And for us to keep a trusting relationship that I could go to them when things happened, which they did. And I owe the success of that integration to them and to me. I didn't cower to it. When things happened, when things would happen, it was uncomfortable at first, not knowing exactly what to do or how to handle the situation. But I just thank those leaders so much that I could ask them for help. Because there's this expectation too, like I felt this social expectation that I, as a woman, as a hard-charging, successful young woman, I'm like the social police, or I should know what to do, or I should know how to handle situations, or as women were coming into the other battalions, I should be the one that is teaching them the right thing to do when I'm honestly learning at the same time. Like I'm figuring it, I'm making mistakes at the same time. I didn't handle everything perfectly. And there's a whole learning curve of learning things the hard way, not necessarily having other women to go ask. And I was just so focused. I don't even know if I would have asked. I didn't have a senior woman pulling me aside and being like, I'm here for you. I'm here to help you. And I'm not saying that should be assigned or anything like that. Like, but I just didn't have that. We didn't have enough women yet in that culture to do it.
And so you mentioned earlier that you had gone to airborne school while you were a cadet. So how was that?
Before I went to airborne school. And so I remember like walking, like seeing a captain and being like, oh my God. And like contemplating turning around and walking the other way. Cause I had never actually saluted. So it was almost like sending me to airborne school without like going to basic training or anything. You don't really learn that much in your first year of college. And basically learn what the ranks are and how to wear a uniform and all that. But looking back on it, like, so we have a platoon at the time, my platoon, there's probably about 80 of us in a platoon, 70, even just the way in our squads that they would structure us from far right, you know, the first position, first spot in your platoon, it would go in an order of male officers, female officers, male NCOs, female NCOs, male junior enlisted, female junior enlisted, male cadets, female cadets. It's already structured, men are in front of women. And on the first day, you know, our NCOs pulled us in and pulled me and my roommate in, who was also a female. And I can share this story because they don't do this anymore. So it's military history at this point.
So that's almost about 15 years ago. And I went at 19 years old. So I was really naive and very young. And it was the first time that I'd ever even had a military experience. First time I truly saluted anybody. And I was pretty anxious, pretty nervous. It's different when I put Sydney back into that headspace going through it versus me now looking back on it, because there was, it's just really interesting about how the Army was presented to me. And I was so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I was just so excited in general. But even the structure within our platoons, the squads, the rank of seniority, of importance, like our squad structure would go male officers, female officers, male NCOs, female NCOs, male junior enlisted, female junior enlisted, male cadet, female cadet. So there's already a structure of men being more important and more prioritized. And on the first day, I was pulled into the cadre's office with my roommate, who is also a young woman. And they handed me this Super Mario stuffed animal. And they were like, your name is now not like Charlie65 or whatever my roster number was. And they were like, you are the platoon mascot, and your name is Mario. And here's the stuffed animal that you have to have on you at all times. Like, you cannot be seen without it. And you're allowed to bring around disposable cameras and take pictures of wherever you want to go, whatever you want to do. And at the end, you're going to give us those pictures and we're going to put it into an album. So like, young 19-year-old Sydney, who's like still pretty naive, is like, oh, okay, cool. This is awesome. Like, I'm going to have a blast, and I'm getting artistic with it. Like, I'm taking really cool pictures, making sure everybody in the platoon is in one picture at least. And I go and get doubles when I got them developed. I got doubles because I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm going to get to keep these pictures. On the last day, I went in, I made a photo album and everything, and I turned it in, and they were like, where's all the good pictures? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I mean, I'm like laying down in the prone, taking like really cool angles and everything, and they showed me the other albums. And I'm like, oh, and they don't obviously do that anymore. I didn't even realize, I didn't even at 19, like, I didn't even realize how messed up that is. It's full circle with today, with what I'm doing, where like, where people don't realize, you know, like, once you mature and you're an adult, right, and you're 28, you're 29, you're 35, say, even people my age, 33, and senior leaders in their 40s, they forget what it's like to be that young and naive. These young women coming into the military, and these are their first experiences. And yeah, you know, that might not happen anymore. The whole mascot thing, because I'm the youngest blonde, tall, thin, you know, and I don't want to sound arrogant with it, but they picked me for that. And I don't think I fully processed it. And there's a lot of women that certain things like this happen to them. And these are their first experiences, and they may not be fully processing how serious that is. You know, that's wrong. That's, you're sexualizing and you're making a joke out of it. You're making it not a big deal, but the standard of what we hold ourselves, what women hold men to, that standard is then set at that low level, or this is the expected treatment, or this is what it's going to be like. And that standard is already set so low, and that tolerance is already set so high. And it can become a pretty disastrous thing in some places and some cultures and in units. And it took me a while to actually, it probably took me until years later for me to reflect on that and be like, that was so messed up. Because again, I was so young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so weird these days to read, you know, that I still read comments on posts military women make on Instagram or whatever other social media things, and just to read the comments from men, and some of them are like, she's not a woman, she's a soldier, like, stop making things different and stop talking about it. But I think because that stuff happens, like, we need to talk about it until it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Like, okay, so you don't want me to talk about senior NCOs expecting me to take hot sexualized pictures of myself with a stuffed animal at 19 and share them and put them in a photo album for an office or at a bar drinking underage? Okay, so you don't want me to talk about that. Then don't freaking do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think that there's so much of that that goes on that a lot of people in the military and outside the military just don't realize. They have no idea. And then jumping back ahead again, I guess, at the 82nd Airborne. So how did it feel then to have leaders who were supportive of you?
Oh, it was awesome. It was like the same as like paying for a coach you wanted to play for. And yeah, there's going to be issues on the team. You know, it's almost like imagine a really good basketball player playing on a men's basketball team and she can hang or she's on the staff or something. And you've got a coach that believes in her, and I was good at my job. Like I went into a shop that had the worst HR metrics in the for the battalions of, like, I think it's like 27 battalions in the division, and we had the worst HR metrics. And even my brigade commander came down and like got 3 inches from my face and was like, "You need to fix this shop. Like I don't care that you're a woman. I don't care if you were a man. Regardless of who you are coming in here, you need to fix what's going on HR-wise." And I was like, okay, you know, so that was my focus. And being able to do my job, even when the treatment or noise from other people or things happened, knowing that I had top cover and knowing I had coaches that wanted to protect me and allow me to do my job, allowed me to do my job. And it gave me the confidence to speak up. It gave me the confidence to be aggressive and lead and tell people to shut up or tell people, like, put people in their place when they needed to be. That gave me the confidence to speak up and maintain my identity. So that was great. But there were things that, again, little things, little microaggression things that I would brush off, but they did, they would affect me, you know, like I think that was really when, like just having a spotlight on you all the time or not being saluted or like little microaggression things that you can brush off in the moment and turn into motivation. If you don't fully, like, you can't keep ignoring it at some point because that memory is somewhere in your brain. It's sitting there somewhere. And I started to notice more of just being watched, you know, just that starting to have that feeling of eyes on you all of the time. Or if you make a mistake, it's that much bigger of a deal. And that I started to realize that there. But I think my competitive spirit inside of me was like, oh, it's okay. Like, I can deal with it. I can handle it. And I did. I handled it. But there were definitely days or situations that were pretty difficult for me to handle.
And so you said you were able to sort of be aggressive and put people in their place if you needed to, but I know some people are a lot more hesitant to do that. Like, what would you say to women who might be a little more reserved and nervous to do that?
I think you need to surround yourself with people that encourage you to do that. And sometimes it might be people that you least expect. It might not be those studs in the unit. It might not be those Captain Americas. It might not be those people that everybody looks at and worships. It might be some of the least expected people that you can create friendships with that encourage you and help build your confidence, that support you when you take the risk of speaking up for the first time and don't shame you for it or don't make fun of you if you do it the wrong way. Because it's practice. It's you have to start with the small things. And it's like developing a muscle. It's like you're going to the gym to work on legs. Socially, you need to work on your presence and you need to work on being able to address things or work on your confidence. And if you stop working on it, it'll depreciate and you'll lose strength in it. So that's how I describe it to a lot of the women I talk to, where it's brain workouts. You have to treat working your brain like you're working your body. And I think, one, it takes practice with small scenarios. Not even necessarily in the workplace, it could be outside of work, and just working on that confidence of speaking up for yourself and speaking for yourself is another thing too. And surrounding yourself and making those friends and finding those people that do support you. And they may not even be in your unit. It may be online. It may be a mentor that you met and you have weekly phone calls with them, or it might be a friend that's on post, or it might be a roommate, but surrounding yourself and with people that do support you and do believe in you is the first step.
And so when you're hearing about these first women going through Ranger School and Ranger School opening up to women, did you immediately think that that's something that you wanted to do?
I was so intimidated by them. I was like, these are the most badass women. They are so cool. Like, they ran as a clique on Fort Bragg. I was asked to go, like, be a part of that first, like, pre-Ranger group of women. But I chose to deploy because I wanted to deploy. I was like, okay, well, if they're opening up Ranger School, that could always be a something in the future, but I don't want to miss a deployment. That was when they started to, like, cut down on deployments, too. So that was more important to me. And then I think coming back and, I mean, again, I was an assistant. I was a postal platoon leader, so I didn't know that culture yet. I didn't know that culture of the women who were doing CST or doing some cooler shit than I was. I didn't know that culture yet. So when I came back from that deployment and was in an airborne infantry battalion and kind of got that title of being the first female in one of those units, and that helped my confidence. And then realizing I could hang with those guys, like I could hang physically. I was crushing at my job. Like I was making friends. I was dealing with the bullshit in good ways. Like I was learning, I was making mistakes, but I was learning and I was building my confidence. I was like, oh, I think I could do this. Like I see other guys that have the Ranger tab or guys that would go to Ranger School and come back or platoon leaders that had failed Ranger School. And I'm like, I'm better than you. And I'm like, I think I could do this. So that was when I started realizing I could do this. Because to me, those first women were, I mean, like Kristen, I mean, those girls were, to me at the time, it was unattainable. And they were just rock stars to me. But once you put yourself into that environment and you start realizing I could do this too, it's addictive.
Did you know any of those women or did you get the opportunity to talk to them about Ranger School?
So my best friend that was a lieutenant went to pre-Ranger. She passed pre-Ranger on Fort Bragg, and then she failed the ruck in rap week. And she was the most physically fit girl that I had ever met. And I was like, oh my God, if she can't pass the ruck, like there's no way I could do it. Now going through that school and going through Ranger School from the 75th Ranger Regiment, and being the first female to do it from the Ranger unit itself, and what I experienced there, whether the women in that first group that went to Ranger School or not truly share probably what they faced, because I've talked to some of them, and I'm not going to speak for them, but I don't fully think the truth of some treatment may ever be known, but at least with what happened to me being the 18th to graduate Ranger School, and what I faced, I could only imagine what they went through. And I hope that some of them continue to be courageous to share truly, because I think there's a number of women that want to hear it because they want to be prepared for it, not because we want to complain or anything. It's because we want to be prepared for what the reality is because we want to be successful. So I could only imagine what they went through. I mean, my friend, she would never make excuses or anything like that. I don't even see it as excuses. It's just the reality of what it is. I still think she's the most physically fit person. I wish she passed. She deserves it.
And so you were saying that you could hang with these guys physically. What were you doing for workouts and physical training at the time?
A lot of running, weightlifting. I had some friends like lieutenants and captains. I would go to the weight room and I would lift with them and they would be like, all right, we're going to get on a Ranger School prep program and stuff. But my job was hard. It was, I would be in the office at 5:45 every day for my first meeting at 6 a.m. I would do PT at 6:30. I would be at work. At least one night a week, I would be sleeping in my office because that was my focus. Was by the end of that job, by the end of that 2 years, about 18 months into it, we were then the best battalion HR wise in the division. So we went from the worst to the best. And that's not all on me. That's just on me working the systems and figuring out what works and then just being completely dedicated and married to it. So physical fitness was important to me, and I would work out and everything, but I wasn't able to fully train for Ranger School or fully train to be at my best fitness when I was in that job, because it was grinding. It was really grinding. It included deployment too. So I did get very physically fit, running, lifting weights, really getting into the weight room for the first time, getting comfortable with weights, getting comfortable with barbells and dumbbells and different exercises, and just building that confidence physically within myself. I'd always been athletic, but it's different to be in basketball shape than infantry ranger shape.
Mm-hmm. Was it sort of more CrossFit style workouts?
I did not get into CrossFit until I did my second deployment with the infantry, Airborne Infantry Battalion. We deployed to Mosul and Erbil, combat deployment. And I came back to go to the Captain's Career Course for 6 months. And that was where I decided to put a packet in to go to an assessment selection for the 75th Ranger Regiment. And that was when I truly got into CrossFit. That's really the first time I committed to it. And I was doing CrossFit every day, running in the morning and CrossFit in the afternoon, and eating as much as possible to put weight on.
Yeah, I feel like some of the most fit people that I've seen on military courses are people that are heavily involved in CrossFit.
Yeah, and there was a physical standard I needed to get to, and at the time that was the fastest way for me to get to it, and it was a fantastic gym. Like the gym that I was going to, they were extremely supportive. They knew their stuff. I felt comfortable there. Great environment. So it was just a healthy place for me to do it and to get as strong as I possibly could really fast to go to selection.
So with the physical standards or the tests that you had to do beforehand, was there one certain exercise that you had the most trouble with?
Probably the pull-ups. I mean, I had never done 6 pull-ups. I'd never even done a pull-up before on my own until I started training. I'd never had to. It wasn't even required of us for women at airborne school when I went. I don't have any shame in saying that. I never had to do a pull-up before. So that was my biggest concern. And by training for pull-ups, I would be fine with my push-ups. My sit-ups were never a problem. Running, I was good there. But the pull-ups were a concern of mine. And for me, rucking is just heart. Like, it's not just heart, but a lot of it is heart. It's grit. It's just doing it, getting into the right mindset. The pull-ups were my biggest concern. But once I got one pull-up, I was so excited that I just started cranking them out and getting pretty good at them.
Yeah, the first one is always the hardest to get.
I just wasn't getting anywhere. Like, once you get halfway up, then it's easy to... But I couldn't, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is so embarrassing. But then it was, you know, once you get it, it's okay, this is how you do it.
What did you find the best method to train for them? Because I know some people prefer the bands, or some people prefer doing sort of like the negative eccentric pull-ups.
For me, it was just developing my biceps. I have pretty thin arms, scrawny basketball player. So getting that muscular strength in my biceps was the most important thing. So doing a lot of curls, a lot of different exercise for my biceps once I did my first pull-up, I felt my biceps completely engage, and I felt the actual strength in them. And I was like, oh, okay, that's where I pull from. Okay, I'm gonna keep getting those stronger. And I could physically feel myself pulling my biceps. So I just started focusing on those, and they came a lot easier.
What does it look like then when you get to Ranger School?
So I went through Ranger Assessment Selection Program to get to the 75th Ranger Regiment prior to Ranger School. So I went through that 3-week assessment, the second female to go through there, and was hired as the regimental S1, second female in that unit. And so I was already in that unit prior to Ranger School. I trained for that selection knowing that by training for that selection, I would be good for Ranger School. So that my heart and my focus was on that selection. It's a higher physical standard, higher push-up, higher, you know, harder run, you know, just in general, the PT is harder. So I knew it was prepping me for Ranger School. And I needed to complete Ranger School to keep my job. So it wasn't like I was doing it because it's an option that I can go do, or I'm curious about it, or I just want to do it, I had to. I couldn't be a senior leader, especially as a female there, like as a primary staff officer, as a brigade staff officer. The position was for a senior major, and I was pretty much a brand new captain. I needed it. So there was extra pressure there, and it was just game time. It was just like, let's fucking go. Like, this is it. This is what we're fucking doing right now. And it is not an option to not achieve this. No matter what happens, do not quit. No matter what treatment happens, deal with it at the end. And, you know, I just had the mindset, you're either taking me out on a stretcher or you're taking me out in handcuffs, because this is happening. So yeah, I was pretty pumped up. And I just wanted to get it done so I could get back to my job.
And so was this a job that you wanted to do and sort of sought out, or did you get posted into that position and then they said, like, you need to go to Ranger School to keep this?
So the only way to serve in the 75th is to go through a selection. Depending on your rank or your position, it might kind of dictates which selection you go through. So for me, I did a really good job in the 82nd in that unit as that female, and with the integration with my craft as AG. And typically, the AG branch, we don't have the reputation of going for really hard elite jobs. And the ones that do, once they're in that community, they're in that community and they're probably never leaving it. But it's a very small population. And it's not like the infantry, where since before you even choose infantry, your goal should be Ranger School, and your goal should be these USASOC units or these special operations units. It's not like that for my branch, which also probably motivated me to do it because I just wasn't really that impressed physically with my branch. And I loved the infantry culture, and I loved supporting that infantry battalion. And I wanted to keep being around those guys, and I wanted to keep supporting the guys that I thought had the hardest job. And it kind of goes back to my cousin being a Navy SEAL and wanting to choose the branch and to support, in my mind, the Army Rangers are like the Navy SEALs, and I want to take care of them. I want to work for them. So I was like, I can't imagine going to any other type of unit. And that's why I was like, okay, I put a packet in to go to 75th, or at least to get selected to go to their selection. Because they're constantly getting packets from people trying to work there or get picked to go to their selection. And I had already known that they were interested in me because it's hard to find AG officers that want to go do that type of job. So I already knew they kind of had their eye on me. And then once I decided to go for it, I put my packet together and went to selection. So yeah, it was a choice. Like, you have to choose to want to go to assessment, to selection. The Army doesn't pick who goes to selection. The unit themselves don't rely on Human Resource Command. So we have Human Resource Command that manages all of the manning and everything. But that unit, majority of USASOC units recruit and hire themselves.
It is pretty neat that you can do a job that seems to challenge you more intellectually and be in line with what you want to do, but then also on the side have the option to do sort of the more difficult courses and the more hardcore type of thing.
I mean, it's like it's a mixture of it. Like, I love what my craft is in HR, and I love being in those difficult units. So to me, it was like kind of the right fit.
And you said that at Ranger School, they're either going to take you out on a stretcher or handcuffs. Did you ever have any moments going through where you thought to yourself, okay, no, this isn't what I wanted. This is harder than I thought. Maybe I don't want to do this. Or were you just focused the entire time?
Yeah. I mean, those thoughts might cross your mind of like, is this really what I want? But it wasn't about me. It was so much bigger than that for me, just especially going, you know, it was a real wake up call. Like, and I'm not speaking poorly on the 75th. There are amazing people there, but the people who, especially the ones that were not in that unit anymore, that hold their identity in that unit, which I understand. I understand where they're coming from. Like, I understand that you can lose your identity and it'll completely become your unit. But I had already started receiving so much pushback, even just wanting to go to selection, even just wanting to go to RASP. People are already starting to criticize me for wanting to do that or training for it. So I already had started to experience that rejection and doubt. And so by the time, training for selection, training for Ranger School, it was well before I got to that school did I have in my mind, this is bigger than Sydney. This is bigger than me. And I have to do this for my unit. Like, I have to do this for the 75th. I have to do this for the 82nd, like my home. I have to do this for those younger Sydneys that, like myself, that didn't think I could even get to that position in the first place. When they opened up Ranger School, I was like, I would never be able to get there. And then I was there. So there's plenty of second lieutenant Jaxes out there that don't think that they can do this. And I'm going to show them that they can. So when I would start having doubt, or when I would start thinking selfish, I'm too emotional, and too empathetic, I think, to give into that. And just some of the treatment, a lot of the treatment, I was so fucking angry and disappointed. And like, you're not going to win. I'm not going anywhere. Like, you can try whatever you want, but I'm not going anywhere. And if I fail, I'm coming right back. So it was that mindset.
I have read anecdotal bits online of women who have gone to Ranger School, and I just read Lisa Jaster's book. And, you know, I see the comments online from these men who, you know, have a cousin's uncle's friend's brother that said that they taught on the Ranger course and they lowered the standards for the women. But from what I hear, you know, it almost sounds like they made it harder and they made it worse. And they were held to a higher standard.
It's taken me years to get to the point where I will just flat out say it's not true. It was harder. And I have no hesitation saying that. I don't care what narrative, I don't care what excuse or what story that they want to spin to tell whatever narrative that they want or to show whatever proof. It's not true. The standards it wasn't dropped. It was fucking harder. And I can't speak for anybody but myself, but going through as a captain, going through selection, going through already being in airborne infantry units where people have their Ranger tab and already knowing what goes on there, and like spending, I did the school twice. I did every phase twice. And I'm looking at guys who have no idea what they're freaking doing and getting goes for their op order that I wrote them word for word. I wrote their script and they're getting a green on their op order. And then when I write the exact same thing, it's completely torn apart.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, like you said, how angry and how frustrating that would have been. But it's almost like then if you do quit, then that's exactly.
That it lets them win. It gives them that. And I never had a general walk a lane with me. I never had any. If they did, it wasn't there to help me, because they would have spotted mistreatment and they would have done something. And if I get crap for saying that from somebody in the Army, then whatever. But that's the truth. That's what happened.
What was the hardest part about that school for you?
The heartbreak of treatment. I think it was that loss of innocence. I think for women, I think there's always a point at which in our career where you lose that innocence. And that happened there. Where it didn't matter how good I was. It didn't matter how smart I was. It didn't matter how hard I was working. It didn't matter how good of a teammate I was. It didn't matter how much I was sacrificing for the guys in my platoon or helping them, or didn't matter how much I was following the Ranger Creed. There's just bad people in positions of influence. And that was heartbreaking to see, because I put it on such a pedestal. Like, I genuinely put the Ranger Creed in my heart, and I genuinely was willing to give everything I possibly had. I mean, I'm there to take care of these guys. Like, that's the irony of it, is like, I'm not even there to be an infantry platoon leader. I am there to take care of you and take care of your families, and you hate me this much. you hate me and you despise me and you're telling me that I'm ruining the culture and that I'm ruining the legacy of a unit because I'm there to take care of you and your family. Like that was heartbreaking to hear. And it's motivating as hell because I'm like, okay, you're an asshole and I'm not going to quit to somebody like you. You're not going to have that over me. And you know what? Like, it sounds like I'm complaining a lot, but I don't think it's complaining because to me, you know, doing every phase twice, that was twice as, and I say this in other podcasts, like that was twice as many young men, privates and specialists, sergeants, other lieutenants that were in my platoon that were amazing. I made some of the greatest friends there. I had a fantastic time with my peers and with the other guys in my platoon. And that was twice as many of those guys seeing it. And hopefully being like, I'm just not going to be like that. Like, this is fucked up. And I see what's happening. And it was twice as much exposure to those young men that hopefully won't change the narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And after that finished and you went back to working at the Ranger Regiment, what was that like?
Extremely purposeful, difficult, you know, hard job. I had challenges that I had to fix in the manning. Again, I think that's why they had their eyes on me, because I had already shown that I can fix HR problems. I can fix manning problems. So there were things that I had to focus on and fix, and I had to work through. There were just systems that needed to be recreated to just make it function when it came to the HR perspective. So there were challenges that I had to focus on. And I think because of that, I never fully processed what happened to me at Ranger School, and I never fully had a chance to just process it. And I just tried to kick it out of my brain. And that is not the right thing to do. And there were a lot of traumatic things that happened to me at school. And my body was really, it was pretty broken. And I just would ignore it, do my best to ignore it. And I did well at my job. You know, once I went back into that position, I had social challenges again. I think it was the celebrity stuff as well. I'm still the only AG female ranger 4 years later. And I was the first female with the Ranger scroll and with the Ranger tab. And there was a lot of attention, a lot of hate. And I think I just became so numb to it. I disassociated from a lot of it and just focused on my job. It was probably about 4 or 5 months later the paranoia started. Just knowing what was being said and knowing the amount of pushback coming out of somebody who's doing this It was bad. And I never really talked about it. I couldn't talk about it. I didn't do interviews. I didn't do anything like that because I'm also in a unit where all of that stuff is very much controlled. The public affairs office there is very much controlled. So I know they did their best to try to protect me from it. But you can't protect everything. And I just started to avoid public places. The paranoia started to become like I would see things. I'm also coming out of 6 months where I was hallucinating a lot. I didn't, like, my brain was still damaged. And then I'm dealing with a lot of attention and a lot of pressure and a lot of social stuff. And it just became a lot. Like, at some point, you know, your brain is going to break and your body's going to break. It was just tough. I didn't even see myself slipping. Because, again, the women like us, like, it's all based on your work performance. And if my work performance is not slipping, then I'm not slipping. And if my work performance is getting done, if people are congratulating me for what I'm solving and how the office is working and how the operations are working and how things are getting better from work, that becomes your identity. And all of the other stuff doesn't matter. You know, all of the other, starting to hate myself for being a woman, starting to question my femininity, my relationship becoming a problem, isolating myself from my family, not going out in public, you know, having night terrors and waking up screaming and sweating in my sleep, or hearing things, like seeing things, like physically seeing people staring at me when they're not. So all of those things didn't matter because my job was getting done. And that's not good.
If you could go back or maybe give advice to someone who is sort of in that same position and potentially having trouble healing after Ranger School? Like, what would you have done differently?
I would have immediately started going to the psych. So I didn't start going to our psych until I went a few days with barely eating anything and almost collapsing and then texting them and being like, I need help. So that was the point that I had gotten to. And nobody knew that I was having disordered eating problems because I'm in a uniform. You can't really see your body or anything. Like, I kept it so, I hid it so well. And it also might be that people didn't know me well enough to even see it. And maybe because I didn't let them in to see it well enough, you know, or open up enough for them to know me. But I definitely, for those women, like, you just start immediately going to the psych and immediately start working on that. And the other things will start to kind of fall into place. And being able to allow somebody else to help you realize what you need. I was not even in the capacity of knowing what I needed. Nothing was about me. It was all about my job. So I couldn't even at the time have, I would have even said I'm fine because I was lying to myself to get my job done.
Were you hesitant to go to the psych because you were thinking of potential career implications?
I think I was more hesitant because I was too scared of the reality of what was happening in my personal life and in my own mind, that I didn't want to face the reality of what I was going through. And I didn't want it to jeopardize my job. Like, I didn't want it to jeopardize my work performance, or I would just be like, oh, but I have a whole day of meetings and work I need to do. I don't have time for it. And I would just create excuses to avoid the reality of why I needed to go.
And what else did you do other than the psych for self-care or healing?
Nothing. Once I hit my 2.5 years there, and once my replacement passed his selection, and he PCS'd to my job, then I went through, COVID happened, and this sounds really messed up, but it couldn't have come at the better time for me, because it forced me to be isolated and it forced me to be alone and not wear my uniform. And so I PCS'd to Orlando, Florida for a year in a training with industry assignment where I learned software. And that's what I'm doing now, is implementing that into Army talent management and HR stuff. It forced me to be alone and heal and just isolate myself. And every day I was doing a lot of intense self-work and a lot of therapy. I did about 6-7 months female athletes with disordered eating program. They almost sent me to an inpatient program for my disordered eating. So those last few months, it was every day of the week I was doing something, whether it was psych work, behavioral health, or dietitian. Because I think once I started talking and once I actually started sharing, I think people were like, holy shit, because I didn't say anything.
I think that happens a lot where some people who, you know, you see as these sort of high performers and high achievers, and then find out, I mean, sometimes it's even years later, that everything wasn't all perfect for them. I think it's definitely a lot more common and something that we need to talk about more.
Yeah. And I talk to a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of guys that reach out to me on my page too. And because they want to do that, they want to do that use of sock thing. They want to do the special operations thing, or they want to be the best platoon leader that they can be, or they're lieutenants and they're like, how do I not end up being an asshole? Or how do I avoid mental health stuff? Because they may have childhood trauma or something. And it's like, there's a huge preventative thing from doing therapy and behavioral health and psych work. It doesn't have to be reactive. It's preventative too. Again, it's going back to, we need to start talking about the fact that we need to train our brains like we are training our bodies to be able to handle conflict or social conflict or improve empathy or improve different thinking styles. That all comes from behavioral health and therapy and psych work, and starting to look at it as a workout for your brain.
So you mentioned your page. What made you want to start your Instagram page?
I PCS'd up here to DC a year and a half ago, and I had completed a lot of therapy. I was in a new space. At this point now, it was years of being in the combat arms world, and then now I'm not. I'm in the Pentagon world, and I think it was maybe a little bit of homesickness from it too, homesickness of that culture. So I posted in our Female Ranger Facebook group, which I'd never even been a part of, and I joined it last February. And I posted a whole thing in there of like who I am, what my story was, the units I've been to, and what I went through, psychologically what I went through, because I went through the whole page, and a lot of it is prepping for school, which is extremely important, and it's a beautiful page. It's an awesome page. But I didn't really see anything about the psychological, emotional, and social cultural stuff. So I shared a really long post and was feeling really insecure about it and being like, oh my God, people, I'm already out of touch. Like, I'm not a big female empowerment group person. And it was incredible how many women were reaching out to me for help or just being like, I have been really struggling and I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one that had these problems. I'm suffering from this, this, and this. Oh, this type of substance, a potential addiction social action that's destructive or paranoia, or I'm feeling the same as you. And it was weeks of my phone, just constant phone calls and having these discussions. And I'm realizing all at once, I'm realizing like, holy shit, one, I'm not a failure. You know, I'm not weak. I have a story that these women need to hear, and I wasn't a failure. You know, I did my job really well, and I didn't do my job of taking care of myself the best. And there's other women that are doing the same thing. Like, these women are crushers, man. Like, they're doing hard jobs and they're doing really well, but they're experiencing the same mental shit that I went through. And we're all going through this and we're not talking to each other and we're not sharing it. And like, even my girlfriends that like we were there together, not like romantic girlfriends, but like friends that were girls, like, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I don't want to get in trouble having like, you know, relationships if I'm not supposed to or whatever. So like, even my friends that were girls at Regiment, like, I reached out to them and asked them like a couple years later, and they're like, yeah, I was going through that and it's like, I feel like we don't share the really hard side of it with each other. One, for the same reason I was talking about before, is like that reality check of that fear of the reality that they're not going through it and it's me and I'm the problem, when we're both going through it at the same time. And if we just talk to each other, we can lean on each other and just know, bottom line, we're not alone and we're not crazy. And we don't suck. We're not failing. We're not crazy. We're not the problem. We're just all going through the same stuff, and we need to start talking about it and telling each other about it and teaching each other what works and what doesn't work. So that all led into this Instagram page.
And so what is the importance of mentorship for you?
It's something that I never had from a woman that I wish I had, and I think it would have really helped me. I had fantastic friends that were girls that were there for me, but they could only understand so much. And I think mentorship really took a completely different purpose to me, being the mentor to these younger women and realizing how bad they need it. And it's not that how bad they need me. It's my experience, how badly they want to be successful and how badly they need that, just that love. They need a big sister. And I know what that's like. I didn't realize how badly I needed it until I'm having these conversations with these younger women and knowing how much they need it and being like, fuck, man, I should have started this a long time ago. I should have started doing this a long time ago.
Do you think that a woman needs to have a woman as a mentor and a man needs to have a man as a mentor?
I think people need to have mentors of all types. I think women need to have male, female, gay, straight, white, black, non-binary. I think everybody needs to have a complete diverse inventory of mentorship. I don't think it should just be women going to women. I don't think a brand new woman coming into a unit should automatically be paired with a woman. I think they should be paired with who they click with, but they should have an inventory of a complete diverse group of people that they can turn to continue to grow and learn and not be closed-minded.
Awesome. I never had the woman mentors going through my career either. And I guess some of the people that I will message or call when I'm having something going on in my career that I need advice for are men. It's so neat to see on your page, you know, you'll post like oh, there's a woman wanting to do this course at this base. Like, does anyone know anyone? And then you just make those little connections through your network.
And I'll be honest with you, there's junior women that I turn for mentorship. I turn to them for that. There's captains and there's lieutenants that like I reach out to for advice for myself too, because I don't know it all, and I try not to act like I know it all, but just having that community of people that they just get it. Like we have a like interest, a like crazy screw loose. I have some of my best friends are women, but they didn't go through what I went through. And there's things you can't explain. There's treatment that you can't explain, but you have a connection and you have a common understanding. And it's so important to have that, to not feel alone in that.
Well, I was going to say how neat it is, like you were saying earlier, how you get messages from men and, you know, having men follow your page. And that's something with this podcast that I didn't really expect. When I look at the listener data, about 35% of my listeners are men. So that's definitely something that I did not expect when I started it, but I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good men out there, and there's a lot that deserve a lot more credit for being amazing people than they get. And I think it's pretty difficult right now to be a guy and to not feel like you're walking on eggshells, because there's a lot of fantastic guys. There's also a lot of horrible guys out there, a lot of horrible women too. And it's learning how to navigate that. And I think there's, you know, that's one of the things I absolutely loved about being in those all male units, is for the ones that were great. I felt like their sister. I felt like their big sister or their little sister. I felt protected by many of them like that. You know, and there's the, like I said, there's the evil, dark stuff that happens, and but they want to keep learning. They want to know how to lead and create a good environment for women too. And there's a lot of men that reach out to me for advice, being like, can I just pick your brain on this scenario? Like, what's your perspective on this if I handle this situation this way? Or what can I do to support this woman that is in my squad and she's going through this? Like, what am I missing in a way to support her? And that is just that male population feeling comfortable with me to reach out to me for advice. And that happens quite a bit, but there's a lot of guys, I've never met them. They'll follow the page, feel comfortable and not judged, to become a better leader and to become a better man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so amazing to hear, because especially in Canada lately, we've had some bad press with some of the male leaders in the military. And I think that overshadows some of the really amazing leaders. And I wouldn't be where I am in my career now if it wasn't for some really amazing men along the way. So I think that sometimes they deserve a little more attention and love as well.
Yeah. And encouragement to speak up, and like encouragement of like, you're a fantastic man. Speak up for us too. Like, you can hold, you're a part of this too, you know? And I think sometimes giving them that confidence, it helps us too.
And so I have another question. How do you deal with negative comments online? Like, are you an ignore and delete kind of person? Or do you maybe use that as attempting to make it a learning moment for that person?
So I'm continuing to learn. I'm different with how I handle it now than when I started. I am not someone that just leaves all the comments for algorithm stuff, because that's not the environment I want to set. I want women to come, and women and men to feel safe on this page. So I think I've turned probably about 70 to 80% of my posts, turn the comments off, especially when a post is about to go viral. It's a really weird fucking thing to have a post go viral, and I don't handle it well at all. I've had a few posts go viral, and every time it happens, I am really triggered and I fall back into some pretty poor things. Just my eating or just paranoia and stuff. So I get really triggered by it. And it sounds like really ungrateful when it's like, there's people that would do anything to have a post go viral, but it's not like I'm selling a product. It's not like I'm making art. It's not all of that. It's like, I'm opening up about really tough stuff. So whether it seems like that or not, like the conversations and the things that are the motivation behind it, is it's pretty dark for me. So I realized there's a lot of posts where I'm like, oh, this is a pretty controversial one. I'm just going to turn the comments off. And if I get to the point where I delete three horrible, disgusting comments, I'll just turn the comments off. there have been days, even with this project, where it's like every 15 minutes I'm refreshing the comments and seeing what is being posted and deleting and blocking, deleting and blocking, deleting and blocking. And it's like, that is just really not sustainable. That's not healthy and that's obsessive and I don't want to do that. So I'm learning as I go.
It's interesting too, because, you know, you're talking about it going viral, but it's like, okay, if your goal is to be a social media star that's literally just getting paid by YouTube or selling a product, then that's great. Whereas in your case, it's like you want it to go viral among the people that you want to reach and help.
Yeah. And it's every single time a post goes viral, it's great. There's a lot of positivity behind it, but there's also a lot of fucking negativity. And I know that comes with the territory and I want to take this bigger. You know, I want to take this project bigger. I want to see where it can go, but I need to go at my own speed of my own mental health, because I don't want to ever go back to where I was. That's insanity, is setting myself up to go back to the same place. And I don't want that. So there's a lot of hate out there. There's a lot of really disgusting, horrible comments. I've had to report people. Active duty soldiers, you know, junior NCOs saying horrific things to me. And it's like, if you're saying that to a major, what the fuck do you think they're doing to a private? And why are we shocked? Like, why this, you know, why are we shocked when certain things happen in the media when they feel that comfortable? What culture is this sergeant, this E5 sergeant in? What culture has already given him the confidence to say to me things that are just repulsive? He's been given that confidence from somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think about this a lot. It's like, what's the solution? Like, how do we change this? Because I can't even fathom in my mind, like, what makes people think that way and say that kind of stuff.
Not feeling love, I guess. Like, just not feeling love. Because if you can feel the power of love, and I'm not saying like in a monogamous relationship or something like that, and you can receive love in so many ways, and you may not have felt it from your parents, or you may not have felt love ever in your life, but you can feel love from a unit, you know, you can feel love from your culture. And I sound so hippy dippy and soft and whatever, and people are like, oh, well, that's why you have all these psychological problems. Like, fuck off. I did my job really well. And I think it's because you see so many people that don't have love and they don't have that teamwork and they don't maybe feel genuinely a part of a healthy team. And it's sad. Like it's sad to me. It's sad for the victim in my mind. And it's also sad for the perpetrator. That's like, what has gotten you into this mental space and how has it not been caught? You know, what have you not received in your life to keep you happy and healthy and just wanting to see people do better and like wanting to lead with respect? And I think there's just so much hate and there's abuse and there's trauma that's not being treated. What a difficult life to look at life with that much hate. But to answer the question of like, what is there to do? It's a team effort. Honestly, it's having the courage of, especially as a leader, when you have a soldier that's troubled within your responsibility, is not treating them like shit, is finding the help that they need. And that's not coddling them. Sometimes it's tough love. Sometimes it's actually taking the time to get to know them, giving them a little bit more attention and figuring out where is this trauma, where is this pain coming from, and giving them a chance to actually start to trust and learn. It's like, how do you earn the respect and trust of rehabilitating a dog into, I'm not comparing people to dogs, but it's like the same thing. It's like, we can rehabilitate dogs into families and they can be loving, great, great teammates, great partners. We should be able to do the same thing with people.
That is actually a good way of putting it. And so what are your future goals with the Balance Your Grit project? Where would you like to see this go?
Right now, it's shared knowledge. And right now, it's that. It's building the confidence and building that network of there's a group of very active and participating women in this page that are starting to mentor on their own, or I'm starting to be able to trust and learn the personalities and be able to pair women up together. So I'm kind of focusing on that and doing more podcasts and just getting the narrative more commonly talked about. Big picture things, I can only go so big as long as I'm still in the military. Like, I have a job right now where I can put this amount of energy into it. If I were to go to a really difficult job, that's a concern of mine. I would definitely have to dial back quite a bit. Podcasting would be one thing, but I need to figure out a way where I can be more active as like a victim advocate for these really, for these young lieutenants, for these young NCOs and young women, like I was talking about, from that like 19 to 23, 24 age range, and helping them navigate an investigation or helping them navigate to report something and what to expect within the legal system. Because a lot of times they become very intimidated, or they're told certain things, or they are threatened, or they're told to, you know, take things out of their sworn statement, or intimidated, and they fold. And I don't think the full picture is really making it up to the people that need to see what the full picture is. I don't think it's getting to the senior leaders, and I don't think we do a good job of victim advocate, especially for these women in infantry combat arms areas. Because a lot of the times their stories are extremely unbelievable. So how to do that, I'm not sure yet, but I think about it a lot. And I trust that it'll come to me. So I'm trust that the opportunity will present itself. But there's got to be something done for these younger women that know it's wrong, and they know what's happening is fucked up, and they want to do something about it, but they don't even know what to do.
Mm-hmm. And it's intimidating too when you're young and you're new in the military and you see anyone of a higher rank, well, whatever they say you're going to do, because otherwise you're going to get in trouble. And especially if you're not that assertive type of person, you're not going to question any of that.
Yeah. And then what? That leads to hopelessness. That leads to isolation. That leads to imposter syndrome. That leads to lack of trust. That leads to not being able to see a future, not seeing a purpose, not feeling valued. And what act does that lead to? You know, you're in an extremely vulnerable state. So, you know, from one side, now you're a prime victim for somebody that could take advantage of you because you're extremely vulnerable with no confidence. Okay, sexual abuse, sexual assault. You're also too scared to report it. You know, it's all connected. Or it leads to suicide, you know, either one. Or it leads to getting out and hating the military, or starting to hate your country, or not trusting your leadership, or not being able to trust men, not being able to trust anybody. Like, that's what some of these women face. And they still grit through it. They still do their jobs. And they still stay focused. And they still stay loyal. They still stay hopeful. But, and that's that grit, right? And, like, that's the grit that it takes to stay focused and somehow block out all of this extra shit and keep doing your job. But at some point you've got to take care of it, and you've got to get help, or you've got to find someone to talk to. And it's heartbreaking when you hear like the bad stories. It's heartbreaking because that's just one more person that could have been helped. So where I can take this, it's somewhere. I know it'll go somewhere. I know something good will come from it. So good things have already come from it. But how to turn it into something more, I know it'll present itself to me. I'm just kind of waiting for that to happen.
And how much longer will you stay in the military for?
I don't know. I've never been like I said this on another podcast, I'm not like a big goals person, because I don't want to limit myself from any opportunities that present themselves. That's how I ended up at 75th and going to Ranger School and doing Balance Your Grit. It's like, I like to stay fluid with it. So I don't know. As long as I'm feeling a purpose and I'm happy and I'm not, I'll keep doing something. But right now, like what I'm doing with this page, and I don't know if my story has led me to do this and turn this into something more. I can live with that. Like I could live with choosing this over the service right now.
And how did you come up with the name Balance Your Grit?
It's honestly like that, the grit that it takes to do this, and the grit that so many of us women have that keeps us in the fight and keeps us going and keeps us dedicated to our purpose, can sometimes really keep us from taking a step back and getting the help and taking care of ourselves and taking care of that grit. And it's got to be balanced. Like that hard charging shit has got to be balanced with something to stay sustainable, to keep that grit sustainable, or else it can lead to a pretty dark place. And so that's where the phrase comes from.
And my final question that I always ask everyone, what advice would you give to women looking to join the military? And then for you specifically, women that want to go to Ranger School?
So you have got to surround yourself with people that you want to be influenced by is number one. And that kind of ties back to my mentorship thing, which is surrounding yourself with all diversity and stay curious, stay wanting to learn, stay wanting to grow. Volunteer as much as you can for all of the weird stuff that you could volunteer for, the extra duties, the extra weekend taskers, volunteer, because that's where you're going to learn and you're going to meet different people. You're going to find that diversity. You're going to make mistakes and you're going to get to learn from them, which is important as well. It's important to make mistakes. And my other advice is like, nothing is going to come when you want it and nothing's going to come immediately or easy. And you have to be patient, and the minute an opportunity presents itself, that's when you go for it. And I never saw myself being able to achieve the success that I had because I kept the perspective of, I'm just going to work really hard. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to take care of people. I'm going to be a good person as best as I can be and just go for the hard stuff. Like take the opportunity when it's there. And I think there a lot of young people get very discouraged because they don't have that immediate satisfaction and they don't have that immediate sense of achievement. And there's not a lot of firsts anymore, which it doesn't fucking matter. But those opportunities and that purpose will present itself when you stay patient and you trust that they will come. And I see a lot of young people just quitting because their purpose hasn't presented themselves yet. And you got to be patient for that.
And where can people find Balance Your Grit online?
It's on Instagram, balance_your_grit.
Awesome. And is there anything else today that I maybe missed or that you would like to add or talk about?
No, I think honestly, this was one of the best podcasts I've done. Like, you're really good at this. you're really good at the flow and the progression.
Honestly, I never wanted to start a podcast and I'm such an introvert and I'm still like nervous talking to new people.
Don't cut this out either. Leave this in it.
Okay. All right.
No, but thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. And I'm so glad that we finally got to connect.
Thank you for listening. The biggest way to help support this podcast is to leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcasts and Spotify apps. You can also visit my Instagram page at Shoot Like a Girl Podcast to see photos from the guests, keep up to date with the podcast, and find out about any merchandise releases.